Welcome to another episode here on the Get With Zoom podcast, where it's all about surfing, spirituality and creativity. This time, I'm very happy to announce a very, very special guest whose book I've read last year. A book that caught me from the first paragraph and that was so different from everything else that I have read about surfing until then. I'm talking about William Finnegan, the author of the wonderful piece Barbarian Days, with whom I sat down in Berlin last weekend having a pizza, a lemonade and a very nice conversation about his book and therefore about his life of writing and surfing. As always, I would be very happy if you go to iTunes, watch out for Get Wet Soon and leave a little review for this podcast. And now just lean back and enjoy listening to the words of William Finnegan. Today we're sitting here with William Finnegan in Berlin in the Prinzessengarten. So nice to have you here in Berlin. Hi.
It's wonderful to be here. Nice to meet you, Thomas.
You told me that's your first time in Berlin. What does it feel like for you being from New York?
It feels like a big, small town. It's not as I expected. I've been in other parts of Germany that are much more controlled, more precise, Teutonic, what one expects. And Berlin feels very loose. It's hot. This week is a heat wave, so perhaps that's slowed everybody down a little bit. But it's got a very kind of liberal, experimental feeling compared to other cities.
It's really hot right now. It's crazy. You have this reading today of your book, Barbarian Days. What does it feel like reading this book in public?
Well, I read different parts of it on different occasions. Last night, actually, I did a performance at a bookshop. It was quite nice, but all the readings were by other people reading in German from the German translation. So I'm sort of prepared again tonight to read different passages. I mean, it kind of depends on the audience. I'll look out and if it's like... Like if it's a bunch of surfers in some beach town, well, they want some hardcore surfing action. but if it's a more urban audience, older people, I'll read other passages that have nothing to do with surfing and are more sort of narrative and cultural and maybe they have a funny ending or something. I mean, it's sometimes it's rather emotional. I have to be... sort of careful about what I read. I might be reading something about somebody that has died and I suddenly feel terribly sad as I'm reading and I think, no, I don't want to feel like this and you know, be unable to read. So I sort of judge the audience and leaf through the book. It can be fun to visit these old places and friends and stories because it's a memoir, you know, it's an autobiography, so it's like visiting different parts of my life.
You wrote this amazing book, Barbarian Days. So when did the idea of writing this book first come up or first popped up in your mind?
Long time ago. I worked on it for about 20 years and it started with in my real job I write about politics mainly, in long form, not in the news, but the magazine I work for, The New Yorker, lets us write very long pieces, book length pieces, but nonfiction, you know, about other people's problems, the opposite of memoir. But then I wrote a piece about a profile of a surfer I knew, and interesting guy in San Francisco. And after that piece came out, people were quite interested in it. It kind of was obvious that I was a surfer also, and I knew this world. And my publisher said, oh, you know, let's publish that as a book. And I said, no, I don't want to publish this profile as a book, but maybe there's more, you know, there are more stories here of other places, other people, because I've spent my whole life surfing, chasing waves. Like more than 50 years, you know, spending a lot of time. And so a lot of stories. And so that's when the idea started, but it took me so many years to write, literally 20 years to write, with other projects in between, of course. But mainly because I would get into this material and kind of enjoyed the writing, which is unusual for me. normally I don't enjoy writing. And so I wrote it in fits and starts. You know, I'd work for a few months and then put it away, usually because I would start to feel kind of too self-indulgent, you know, just writing about myself. You know, I'm the main character, and I'm sort of trained as a journalist, and I normally write about other people. And whenever I would, in the course of my story, you know, meet somebody really interesting, some guy in Indonesia who has a story to tell, I would follow him and write, you know, about him for 10 pages or 15 pages, and then my editor would see this material and say, "What is this? Why are we listening to this Indonesian farmer about his days in the army?" And I would say, "Oh, it's so interesting." She said, no, cut all of that. The story is you. And but it was a little strange, you know, for an old journalist to always be, okay, me, back to me, you know.
At the center of the world.
Yeah, so I would sort of set it down. I can't keep doing this right now. So I did it in bits and pieces over 20 years.
I read in another interview, so you had
the whole time you had like a diary, so from where you draw your memories.
Yeah, I kept pretty good journals most of my life, and those were very helpful for writing this book. But just as helpful were letters. I used to write a lot of letters to friends and family, and I got a lot of those back. They were returned to me. And those were good sources, and I even had some close friends who let me look at their journals from periods when we traveled together or lived together, and there was more material there. But I think that a real break came. I was working on the book, but I wasn't sure what the shape of it was. And then I got a box in the mail, a big box, unexpected, from an old friend. And he had found this box of letters that I had written to him. He'd found them in his mother's garage in California. Didn't know I was working on this book. But it was dozens and dozens of letters that I had written to him as a kid. I didn't remember writing them. But I'd grown up in California, and then my family moved to Hawaii when I was 13. And these were written when I was 13 and 14 from Hawaii about what I was doing, you know, the surf and my school, and just every day, every night, I would write these long letters to my friend, and he saved them. And so I started reading them, and the writing was terrible. You know, I was 13 or 14, and absolutely everything was bitching. I don't know, you know, if you know that word, but, you know, every wave was bitching, every girl was bitching. So it wasn't the quality of the writing, but the detail was just fantastic. And it was like Proust and his Madeleine, you know. It's like I bit into these letters, and I remember all of it was coming back to me, this period of my life. And I thought, this is where this book should start, in this school, at this moment. And so it was from those letters that I was able to draw most of the first chapter, which is a big chapter.
Yeah. Wow, that's amazing.
Refreshing the memories through those letters as from the 14-year-old. It's crazy.
Yeah, and these were letters I'd written, you know, 30, 40 years before.
Can you tell us, actually, your first contact with the ocean? Do you still have that as a memory?
Probably not, because my parents were kind of beach people in California, and my father loved boats, and my mother had grown up in Los Angeles, and so we were often at the beach when I was small. There are pictures of me as a baby on the beach. I don't remember those situations. Once I started going in the water, first body surfing, learning to body surf, I do remember vividly the excitement of waves, especially slightly bigger waves. Once I could swim well enough, I was probably 5 or 6, and could swim to the bottom and just sit on the bottom and hear the bigger waves break and roll by, and it was kind of exciting but also very comforting. And I would spend hours just swimming under these waves, and as I say, learning to body surf, learning to ride them. I finally got on a proper surfboard when I was about 10, but by then, really, to learn to surf, it helps a lot to body surf, to spend years in the water so that you begin to understand waves before you get on a board, because it's all about understanding waves. That's the main thing. And once you're on a board, you're busy with balancing and maneuvering, and it's better if you understand waves already.
Yeah, you've been traveling the world a lot, and then you decided to go to New York. It was also nice reading in the book where you could read about all your travels, and then this decision to go to New York because of this other love that you had for writing, for journalism. So what was this like?
Well, I really didn't take surfing very seriously. That is, I always did it. It was the main thing I did. But I did it all over the world. I left home for years and spent like 4 years overseas at one stretch, mainly surfing. But I still didn't, that's not how I thought about myself. I thought of myself as a writer. And my journals are not full of surfing. I just, you know, little things, you know, like on a great day, great day of surfing, I might write, "Today was the day," you know, and I'll never forget that day. But there's, what can you say about it? It's surfing. That's how I felt. But I was starting to publish. My first book was coming out. I was becoming ambitious, and New York was just the best place to be, to do the work I wanted to do. But I felt kind of bad because I felt like I'm not going to be able to surf once I get to New York, you know. I didn't want to admit that because surfing wasn't so important to me. But I moved to New York, and for a while I would take vacations, go to Mexico, go somewhere and go surfing, but it's not the same thing as when you live near the water and you're always aware of what the ocean is doing, what the tide is, what the wind is, what the swell is. Even if it's not good and you're not going to surf, you're always aware. So when you go live in a city where you're not thinking about it, I felt like I was not really surfing. And that carried on for a few years, but then I slowly realized that around New York, there are quite good waves, mainly in winter, down the New Jersey shore and out on what's called Long Island. I live in Manhattan, but these places are not far away. And they get quite good in winter, and it's cold, so it's not crowded, and not very well known. So I started surfing more there, and then I started doing some more serious surf traveling. I started going to Madeira, spending the winter on the Portuguese island of Madeira, which gets amazing waves, gets big waves.
It plays a big part in your book also, right?
Yeah, it's a chapter, one of the late chapters in the book, because I'd surfed biggish and bigger waves most of my life, but these were serious big waves. You need specialized equipment, what's called a gun, a type of surfboard they call a gun. So you needed a gun, Madeira, and I really loved surfing there, although it was, you know, it got to be a question of, you know, responsibility, especially once I became a parent, you know, should I keep doing this? And the answer was really no. Similar to, I was doing a lot of conflict reporting, war reporting for the New Yorker during those years. Same thing, when you have a child, you start thinking, I should not be doing this. You know, it's too risky. So I tried to, I stopped going to Madeira, but really started surfing a lot around New York. I surf probably as much there as I used to in California.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, I mean, in the winter, you surf basically every week, sometimes several times a week.
That's cool. Not the kind of feeling landlocked kind of that.
No, I mean, it can be a hassle to get to the waves if, you know, because of the traffic around New York City. But you kind of learn to time it and leave at funny times, like middle of the night, so that you're in the right place at the right time. And it's become so easy to know what the surf is going to be like. Most of my life, you didn't know. You really didn't know. The forecasting, the prediction was either it didn't exist or was very primitive. But increasingly with, you know, computers, you can look online and really know. There's a lot of information there. And so you can say, okay, 8 a.m. at this spot in New Jersey. This is if you know the area well. You say, that's the time, that's the place, you know. And you debate with your friends, you know, because they have different ideas. But you can really be at the right place at the right time. So it's relatively efficient. I can't imagine having like the job I have in Manhattan, the schedule I have, and surfing a lot without all these tools, you know, without being able to look online and know when the waves are coming. Also, I should add, I use those same tools to, and a lot of other surfers do this too, to go long distance. You know, watching like the Pacific Ocean, this time of year, watching the Southern Pacific Ocean, there's some big storms way down south. And when the right storm comes, you realize these waves are gonna be great surf in Nicaragua, you know, in a week. Can I get to Nicaragua next week? And then you start trying to plan around these weather maps. And sometimes you manage to get to the right place at the right time and you know, maybe stay a week and get great waves.
That sounds awesome. Actually, I was never a big fan of like surfing, let's call it surfing literature. I've never read these books. I actually, after 10 pages, I already stopped, and then also magazines, because there was so much cliche stuff going on. But this book was so different, and it was so poetic. So who was your main influence, or which writer did have a big impact of your own writing?
Well, yeah, there isn't too much surf literature. I mean, there's a lot of surf journalism, and maybe some pretty amateurish books, but my favorite surfing books are like an encyclopedia of surfing that this guy put together and a history of surfing. Yes. It's really, you know, it's they're very sort of technical books, but surfing is difficult to write about, because if you don't surf, if you haven't put in many years, if it's not your life, you can't understand it. And people have tried to write books about surfing who don't surf, and it's impossible. It's amazing how difficult it is. I mean, down to the level of grammar, like a preposition, you know, to or for or in or out, all those prepositions in surf language to describe things in the water, those prepositions are very specific. You have to have them all right. And if you don't surf, you can't get them right. Nobody, you watch people try and it's funny, but it's pathetic also. It just can't be done. But if you've been surfing all your life, of course, that's your first language. Yes, it's like this tribal dialect, and you speak it. So and so there aren't too many guys who speak, I mean, lots of people who speak that language, but not too many of them are professional writers. So, I mean, professionalism has nothing to do with it, I guess, but I've written a lot of other books, and this is what I do for a living. And so I was bringing a kind of lifetime of experience, both surfing and as a writer, to this book. And it's a big, you know, it's sort of my autobiography. So it's I really want to get it right. You know, this is my story. And plus, you know, for a journalist, it's a memoir is a weird genre, because this is private life. You know, nothing was on the record. Suddenly you decide, okay, you know, I am going to write about all these shared moments with friends and loved ones without permission. Well, I went back and talked to a lot of people to get permission to write about certain things. And so deciding what to put in and what to leave out, that's all quite difficult. A lot of negotiation, you know, and also to decide what really happened, because everybody remembers everything completely differently. So some of my training as a journalist was helpful there, and some of it was irrelevant. But I'm really glad you like the book.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Is there any writer out there that inspired you?
Yes. Not really anybody who writes about surfing, no.
Not must be about surfing. Of course, like writing in general.
Yeah. Well, my favorite writers have, you know, changed through the years as I'm working on different things myself. I used to write fiction, and in those days my favorite writers were probably James Joyce and some of the obvious people, really, for an American, Ernest Hemingway, and not so much William Faulkner, but other regional American writers that I really loved. Philip Roth, who recently died, was one of my favorite American novelists. And then as I got into literary nonfiction, as they sometimes call it, that's kind of what The New Yorker publishes. There are a number of masters of that form. Some of them work at The New Yorker, John McPhee. There's a guy named James Salter, who was really influencing me, I felt, when I started this book. He wrote both fiction and nonfiction, but some of his nonfiction is really beautiful. But, you know, with influence, you have to... I mean, at a certain point, I had to put Salter away, like put him in a drawer, put him in another room. I couldn't be around him because I felt like something's wrong with this book. It's getting too macho, too the tone is too tight. And that was I'm trying to be like James Salter. He can carry that off. I can't carry that off. I shouldn't be doing that. Okay. So it's, you have to be careful. You know, the writers you love will also kind of lead you into the swamp if you're not careful. The swamp of imitation, I should say.
David Foster Wallace, did he also write for The New Yorker? I don't know.
No, he didn't.
It was Harper's Magazine, right?
Harper's published some of his stuff, yeah. I mean, he was a remarkable writer, a really, really talented writer. But he's a good example of somebody, if you try to imitate David Foster Wallace, it will not go well. Yeah, only he can do that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. That's right.
He was also a master in like essays and fiction.
Yeah, yeah, his big books were fiction, but he wrote incredible essays. And just his thinking was so complex and advanced, and he was quite funny and intensely self-conscious and terribly depressed, which wasn't always obvious when you read. It was almost like his writing was part of the fight against depression, but eventually the depression took his life.
Yeah,
it's really sad. I liked him a lot also. What I also liked at your book, you could read it as a biography, but also like the history of surfing. It was really interesting because you, as an example, went through the whole process of the modern surfing history, actually. So how do you see the development where surfing came to now in this modern culture?
Yeah, that has been the sort of movement in recent years has very much been toward commercialization, the mainstream. Surfing is a sport. Now surfing is going to be in the Olympics, that kind of thing. But it's true, I've lived through a number of eras. I started surfing in the early 60s, and board design was completely different then, and board design kind of determines what you're trying to do out there on the waves. You know, when there were only long boards of a certain type, you could only surf them certain ways. And when there was a kind of design revolution around 1968, suddenly riding much shorter, much lighter boards, you could do something completely different. It was almost like you were out there in the ocean to do a different thing, to stay much, much closer to the breaking part of the wave and so on. And then there were more design developments, more subtle than simply longboard to shortboard, but they've made quite a difference too. And then the increasing popularity of surfing, I don't know. I'm not happy about it. I hope I'm not contributing to it with this book. I've actually been happy to hear plenty of people who read this book said, oh, have said to me, you know, I was thinking about trying surfing, but now I read your book. I don't want to try it.
Really?
Yeah. They say, you know, it sounds too difficult, cold, dangerous, you're always getting hurt, that kind of thing. And I say, okay, good, fine. You know, we don't need any more people surfing. It's gotten so popular that overcrowding, overpopulation is a big problem at the good surf spots. So that's one of the reasons we travel so much, trying to find places that are not known or not well known. And you can surf alone or with just a few other people, because it's, depending on the conditions, depending on the waves, it makes a big, big difference. A lot of good waves, there only one person can be on that wave. It's quite dangerous to have more than one. And there are a lot of people who want to do it. So you end up like a lot of competition in the water. And so the mainstreaming of surfing is not a happy development, for at least not for old surfers like me who've been around and seen places get more crowded.
This was also like a beautiful but also like a heartbreaking paragraph in your book where you describe where you've been out in Nias with a friend of yours, and it was like five people, and then Nias wave itself appeared on the cover of a surf magazine, and like 1 year or 2 years later it was super crowded. This was so, I liked that writing also a lot, because you could feel it like, oh no, now it's over. Like that was really
Yeah.
Sad.
I've gone through that with a number of places. even more dramatically. Nias was a pretty dramatic example. I mean, Nias was a great wave, and it actually changed later. There was a big earthquake, and this is in Indonesia, off near Sumatra, and not the huge tsunami that killed so many people in 2005, but a few months after that, there was another big earthquake right near Nias that had the effect of lifting the reef, making the water much more shallow right where the wave breaks. And it didn't hurt the wave. I mean, the wave is still great, but it's much more powerful now because it's more shallow. So it's a spectacular place. And now, it was always good, but now it's really something. But it's very crowded. I haven't been back, but I want to go. I mean, even though it's crowded, even though it's dangerous, I really want to try Nias in its new incarnation. But even more difficult for me, for instance, was a place in Fiji that my friend Brian and I found. It was on an uninhabited island. Maybe a couple of people had surfed it before us, but nobody knew about it. And so we found our way there. Some fishermen dropped us off. There was no fresh water. It was a very small island. And we camped there. And it had probably the best wave I'd ever surfed in my life, breaking off this island. So we camped there a long time, and the fishermen would come back and bring us water, that was a secret we were going to keep. We were going to take that secret to our graves, you know. And we were really serious about it. In fact, between the two of us, it sounds ridiculous, but we would never say the name of that island. We made up a nickname. That was the only, even to each other, in privacy, that's the only word we would ever use. Like, we want this place to remain unknown. Well, of course, people discovered it. And I picked up a magazine, and there it was on the same thing, a few years later. And somebody built a resort there, and it became highly commercialized. In fact, it became privatized. Like, you couldn't surf there unless you stayed at the resort. That was a new thing.
That's so crazy.
Yeah.
So it happens on the Maldives as well, right?
Yeah, there are some places in the Maldives now where that's true. But this place in Fiji, it was really difficult because I was, you know, disappointed and angry and very critical of this development, except I was so tempted to go back. And eventually I got older, I had the money, and I went back. I swallowed my principles. I went back and, as a paying customer, as a tourist, and they had discovered another wave too. You needed a boat to get out to this wave. So there were two places to surf. And I absolutely loved both places. And I went for about 10 years. Every time I could afford it, every year I kept going. Just, it was like politically indefensible, completely indefensible. A private wave, I mean, it was terrible. But I loved the wave too much. Okay. And then things changed, and now it's open to the public. And it's crowded.
Yeah, after Barbarian came out. So then there came some stuff like the Pulitzer Prize and the summer reading list of Obama. How much did your life change since then?
Oh, not too much. I mean, I still do the same work. Long reported pieces for The New Yorker, and I spend more time talking about this book and traveling around. It's being translated into a number of languages, and that's really nice. But a lot of times I just want to get back to work. I feel like I don't have to justify going surfing quite so much, because it's I mean, for a long time it was kind of a secret thing I did, and my bosses did, like, where did he go? Where did he go? And the answer was, he's surfing. But I would, you know, make up some story about why I was not at my desk. And now I can actually say, you know what, surf was good. And they look at me, okay, yeah, Pulitzer Prize, I guess he can go surfing, you know. And so I think there's a little, that equation has changed a little bit, and I feel a little more confident to chase waves, just a little bit. I mean, I still need to work, and I think maybe to interest foreign publishers, to, you know, have a German edition, a Dutch edition, a French edition. I think probably the success of the book, I mean, it does, it helps a lot. They see that it's selling well in the United States, and it gets good reviews and wins some prizes, and then they're more interested, which is great. You know, I mean, it's good for the book, and it's fun for me to go and see how different people read the book and understand it and can relate to it. I just worry sometimes that it might increase the popularity of surfing a little bit. But I think it's really for people to, I mean, most of the readers are not surfers, and they're not going to start surfing. It's hard to start surfing as an adult. You know, it's something that's much easier to learn as a kid. So it's almost all good.
Okay. How do you see the subject of localism in general?
It's obviously a big issue in surfing. Some places are worse than others. That is to say, you show up as a stranger and people are more or less unfriendly. I've never had a really bad experience of localism. I mean, Hawaii is where I partly grew up, and I still surf a lot. My sister lives there. I go there every year. It's kind of notorious for localism. And yet, I don't think I've ever seen a fight in the water in Hawaii. It happens, but I don't think I've ever seen it. I certainly never had anybody get very aggressive with me, ever. I mean, a lot of it is kind of what you put out yourself. That is, if you are a newcomer at a place, surfing with guys who live there, you need to be very respectful. And it can be tricky because, on the one hand, if you're confident, you want to show them you can surf. So, you know, maybe they'll give you a wave because you can surf. If they think you can't surf, they will never give you a wave. But if you don't want to, I don't have this problem, I'm not so great, but I think some really good surfers, sometimes they paddle out somewhere, they get a wave, they just absolutely rip. I mean, they surf so well, it's annoying to the locals. So there's a fine line. You want to show them you can surf, but you're not going to, you know, show them up, as we say in English. But you just have to sort of, you know, be observant, be diplomatic, and usually it's not a problem. I mean, I often hear from friends or other surfers about situations where no matter how diplomatic you are, it's going to be bad. And when I think about it, I must admit, I have surfed places where the locals were so bad that it was no fun. You know, you get a good wave and you think, nobody's going to drop in on me now. And then they do. And you think, well, that won't happen twice. And then it happens twice. And pretty soon you think, why am I even here? You know, I even the best waves, they won't let me ride. That has happened, I must admit. But it's really the exception in my experience. And there's nothing to be done about it. I mean, it's not like you can, you know, bring your boys down and teach them a lesson. I mean, I would never do that, and it wouldn't work anyway. So it's something to cope with as you travel. But I usually don't find it too bad, and I travel a lot.
But I also spoke to some locals in Ericeira, for example, in Portugal, because I wanted to like a reportage about, let's talk about localism. Yeah. They were also super nice people and just told me that it's all about this respect, and they grew up there, and then sometimes people paddle out and don't greet, don't do anything, showing off and stuff like this. Yeah. I think that must be annoying, kind of.
Yeah, it's... I've never had any problems in Portugal. When I think about it, the worst localism I've seen has all been in California. Even though I grew up in California, you know, it's sort of spot to spot. There are the places you grow up surfing, so those are the few places where you're known, and everywhere else, you're an outsider. And some places in California, including around Los Angeles, which is so crowded, that you think, and often the waves are so bad, you think, what can you be aggressive about here? The waves are so bad, there are so many people, and yet people are. They're into it. It's like they're almost more into the clash, the battle, than they are into surfing. But obviously, if it's like that, you don't want to surf there. It's the more memorable experiences for me with localism are in, you know, good waves, even great waves, where there are a few guys who kind of control that spot, and there's only one place to take off. It can be difficult, but. If it doesn't work, you should just leave.
What did surfing taught you about life?
Oh, that's too big of a question. I mean, it's been such a big part of my life that it's kind of hard to separate. It's not like surfing is this little thing I did and then I went and had a life. It's all kind of one piece. But I think that because a lot of surfers do this, because I've traveled a lot looking for waves, looking for uncrowded waves from when I was quite young, I think I learned to travel and often in kind of difficult circumstances, you know, not in tourist areas, but in very poor places, wilderness or other places where you have to sort of camp or get along well with local people to survive. So surfing can kind of open up your world that way. And eventually I became, my late 20s, I guess, a foreign correspondent, basically. I do mostly international reporting. And I could say, well, I learned a lot of the skills of meeting people from other cultures and getting to know them and getting them to talk to me. I learned that from my surfing days. So there's that. And then there's everything about being self-reliant. You know, if you surf in serious waves and often with not other people around, you really are responsible for yourself in a big way. And, if you make a big mistake, there's nobody to help you. And I think that's kind of useful in life to have experience of that type. It makes you, well, it gives you some confidence, but also gives you a sense that you are responsible for the consequences of the risks you take. And in the kind of reporting I do, that's sometimes an issue. I don't do so much conflict reporting now, but much of my career, that's what I did. And there was a kind of connection there, you know, with surfing bigger waves especially, where you say, well, what are the risks? What is this worth it? And think about how to be as safe as you can while you're doing this thing you love.
Is it okay for you to read it? Is this the one? Is this, I love it so much.
Yeah. This is from when I was quite young. I was living in Hawaii. I was maybe 13 and I just recently left the church. I was raised Roman Catholic, and my parents said, now you're 13, you've had confirmation, it's called the sacrament. Now you're an adult in the eyes of the church. You can choose whether to continue going to Mass. And I was surprised and I decided not to go. So I was kind of in a bit of a, not a religious crisis, but I was a little bit lost. And so this, I'm trying to describe what surfing was like in those days.
That's
in Hawaii.
Paragraph.
Thank you. Here we go. Surfing always had this horizon, this fear line that made it different from other things. Everything out there was disturbingly interlaced with everything else. Waves were the playing field, they were the goal, they were the object of your deepest desire and adoration. At the same time, they were your adversary, your nemesis, even your mortal enemy. The ocean was like an uncaring god, endlessly dangerous, power beyond measure.
Amazing. How long did you need for this paragraph?
I don't know. I think I did a lot of drafts of this book and of that chapter. A lot of drafts of that paragraph over time. But it's the tricky thing about that paragraph for me was, on the one hand, it's really addressed to non-surfers, you know, the general reader like the book is, but where I'm really trying to both describe it and help people imagine what this feels like to a young kid who's, you know, is anybody taking care of me is a question, and especially if you're frightened, if you're in a bad situation in the ocean, you know, is there anybody you can ask for help? And the answer is no. But the tricky thing about writing about this, I'm an adult writing about my thoughts when I was 13. Were these the words I would use when I was 13? No. So, you know, you don't want to start to project this, complex adult formulation onto the kid. And so you're always trying to decide, is this true? Is this really how I understood things? Well, maybe it's not how I would have said it, but this is how I was thinking. You know, this was my feeling about the ocean at this point. You know, I wanted to be out there, and then this thing I loved would become this mortal enemy. I mean, that was definitely the feeling, definitely the experience. And so then I would say, okay, I can write this.
It's amazing. I love it. So regarding this paragraph, so what's your personal relationship to spirituality in general?
You know, that for me has changed a lot over time. As I say, I was raised Roman Catholic in this very strict tradition, which I rejected, although not easily. I mean, my wife has always joked, we've been together a long time, and she always says, oh, you know, you'll be a Catholic again on your deathbed, you know, which I hate to hear. You know, it's not a very nice thing to say, but she's making fun of me. People come back to religion and organized religion. And I don't think that's true, but it was true that in this period where that passage takes place, what we're talking about, I was kind of shifting my allegiance, my orientation into the ocean very much, you know, kind of starting to live on the ocean's rhythms, you know, always knowing what tide it is and what the wind's doing. And
which is a higher power also, right?
Like the very much, yeah. I mean, it's this unfathomable amount of power. And you're engaged with that all the time. And then there are those moments when you're really not just intimately engaged, but where it becomes a sort of existential question, you know, where you're afraid you might drown, for instance. And obviously you survive if you're here to talk about it. But do you go on? Do you go on? Why are you out there? Why? That's asking that question. What's your life worth? What does it mean? Surfing's been a big part of that for me, and to ask those questions and deal with those feelings does put me anyway in a world of greater meaning, you know, of not just the ordinary, you know, make your crust of bread to get through the day and take care of your family. When you're that deeply engaged with something so powerful as the ocean, occasionally your survival is at risk or feels like it's in question, then of course the question of your responsibility to your family becomes front and center, at least it does for me. And you're forced to think about what you really believe, and is it a benign universe? Is there a greater power out there to come to your aid? I've had moments in surfing where I was really scared, and obviously survived, but was surprised afterward by what I did in the crucial moment. And it didn't seem like I came up with that myself. You know, they're just sort of almost animal reflexes, just at the crucial moment. And afterward, I feel like I've been in touch with something greater, so as to do what I needed to do in that moment. But it kind of ebbs and flows. You know, I'll feel really grateful and really sort of wondering about my place in the universe, in the glow or the afterglow or the trauma. Actually, there's some post-traumatic feelings as well, in you know, more dangerous waves. And I'm not a big wave surfer. That's a special thing. I just, you know, everybody has their limit, and when I'm surfing around my limit, that's big enough for me, obviously. And all around there, the question of how the world really works, and what's here besides what we can see, those questions are alive. And they can also be alive in the routine of surfing, you know, not necessarily the peak moments, the terrifying experiences, because if you're surfing regularly, you're in the water, you're really paying attention to the ocean, absorbed in it, you are absorbed in something far beyond yourself. You know, you kind of lose yourself in that, and that has a spiritual aspect for me.
Beautiful. The ocean. What does the ocean mean to you?
Well, it's this. It's kind of everything. You know, it's from the best to the worst, and it, from the most beautiful. I mean, the ocean can be. I mean, a surfer has a special eye, right, for the ocean. You're looking for something, basically something you can use, something you can ride. So when a surfer says the ocean is beautiful, it's not the same thing as a painter saying it's beautiful. Although there are plenty of moments when the ocean looks magnificent, and it has nothing to do with surfing. But one is more tuned in to the idea of great waves and the reality of them when you see them. And they're not necessarily great waves, as they can be tiny, for instance, and very, very beautiful. I find I have more pure appreciation of the ocean's beauty when I'm not surfing. That is, when I'm paddling out, say, I'm on the shoulder, and I'm looking into waves. Sometimes I don't even want to keep going, paddle out farther where I can ride the wave. I just want to stay when it's got a particularly mesmerizing quality. I like to stay on the shoulder and just keep watching these waves. Whether they're great to surf or not, they just have a look. So there's that. And to me, this ocean can also be very ugly. You know, it's that can mean completely unsurfable, you know, ripped by wind and whatever that is tearing up the surface. But also it can just develop a quality that's, it might be grand, but it's also tormented and kind of tormenting for me to look at. And this is all just talking about how it looks, basically, because it's also the next question of how it feels and what it's like to be in there. I mentioned that when I was a kid, I loved to swim under waves and just stay in the water for hours, you know, where my mother would be saying, where is he, you know, he's under the waves out there, you know, his head just pops up every now and then, and I felt like nobody was watching me. That's a kind of double-edged thing. I mean, I liked that, that's how I wanted it, but on the other hand, I felt kind of abandoned, you know. No, you know, these waves are powerful and nobody's watching me, you know, and looking back now from a different era, where parenting is much more
like helicopter parents.
Cautious, yes, helicopter parents like me.
really?
No, I'm not too bad. I have a 16-year-old daughter who's a rock climber, very serious rock climber, really good competitive rock climber. And so I just have to watch her do these things. And there's a lot of safety built into rock climbing. I mean, you're not supposed to be doing something where you can get seriously hurt. But it still can be fairly scary, and I rock climb with her, so I know she's much better than me, so I know how difficult what she's doing is and how scary it is, because I could never do it, but I try to let her make her own mistakes and not be too helicoptering. Anyway, so there's from that end of the spectrum where the ocean is just a comfort. It's like this womb that you could enter when I was a kid. There's from there over through the kind of ecstasy of great surf, of riding great surf, of feeling completely in tune with the ocean, on to this other end of the spectrum, which is where the waves, the ocean seems determined to kill you. And it really becomes your enemy. You know, how can I get out of this ocean? I haven't had an experience like that recently. I was in some pretty big waves in Hawaii a couple of months ago in May, and it was sketchy, but I managed to stay calm through a lot of. I broke my board in big waves, and I had a long, long swim, and the current was heading to a bad place, and so there was a lot to worry about, but I never panicked. It never got to that place of thinking the ocean is trying to kill me, but it was an issue. It was a question: is the ocean trying to kill me today? And I was really, really happy when I made it to shore, but I was happy I'd gone out, even though I didn't have the right board. My board was too small for the weight. It was a big day, and I had a small board. And it broke, but it still felt like I'd done the right thing. I wanted to give it a try. I wanted to be. I'm not in Hawaii that much. I live in New York, and I don't see waves that big that often now. So I wanted to get involved with it, get close to it. And the main experience actually was, as I say, I had the wrong board. It was kind of hopeless to surf, but the feeling for a while being in these really majestic waves. They weren't perfect. They had a little wind on them. They're really difficult to surf, but really big Hawaiian waves were so beautiful to be around. Even while you're intimidated, even while you're scared, you can sort of detach yourself and say, "I'm so lucky to see this." You know, this sort of gratitude just to be up close to it. That was what I was really there for. And then you take all the punishment and
slaps.
Yeah, yeah. The ocean has, you know, a million meanings. It's this place that you, this thing, this force, it's, you know, most of the planet that you get involved with and develop a kind of relationship with that's always developing, you know. And I know that describes me and a lot of surfers, I think, and you know, and fishermen in a different way and, you know, other people who are around the ocean a lot. But it's funny to me sometimes to talk to someone who has no relationship whatsoever with the ocean, which is, you know, plenty of people. They've maybe, you know, been to the beach a few times, but they just have never really spent much time in the water. They're not comfortable there. They wouldn't like to be there. And I feel like, oh gosh, they really missed this big thing. Which isn't to say it's. I've also been plenty of places where. And this is a big part of surf exploration. You know, when you're looking for waves in remote places, where usually there are people living, you know, there are villages, there are fishermen, but not a lot of tourists, not a lot of travelers, not a lot of outsiders. The thing you're looking for, surfing, this powerful wave, usually breaking in shallow water, people really think you're crazy. They have a long relationship with the ocean, you know, generations and generations and generations, the whole culture in a fishing area, and it is not to get near the reef where the waves break hard. That's like the basic thing you do not do. So it's, and you have to respect that. And I've had people get very angry at me when they see what I want, when they see where I'm going. What are you doing there? That is a place where we never go. That is a place where my brother died. That kind of thing, you know, and someone, I'm respectful of your brother. I'm sorry that happened. I'll be okay over here. No, you won't. You don't know that place. That place will kill a man. And you say, well, I know what you mean, but I, you know, and so it can be a difficult conversation and a difficult relationship because people have this profound relationship to the ocean. They draw their food, their livelihood from the ocean, you know, both on the reef and from the deeps, you know, fish and shellfish and grasses and all the things you can get from the ocean to eat. And And I would have to say you have a more profound relationship with the ocean than I do. And yet I'm here and I want to be right there, right in that place you think is crazy. And it's not always a conversation that could be resolved. I mean, people sometimes get interested and they watch you and they laugh and they decide it's okay and they clap or whatever. But just as often they just say, oh, you know, you're an idiot, and we're never going to understand why you're doing this. You know, white people are crazy. So,
but so have there already been like serious situations where they want to hold you back, like this guy?
I don't think I've ever been really stopped from surfing by people who were worried about it. I certainly had to like change boats. You know, like these fishermen say, no, I'm not going to drop you off there. If that's what you're planning to do, the answer is no. But, you know, find somebody else who will say yes.
Yeah. With more money.
Yeah, maybe more money or just a different attitude. And I can't remember ever being completely blocked and completely frustrated. You know, we want to surf, and I've certainly been places where people say, you can't go in the ocean now. Like, it's Sunday. You can't surf on Sunday. And you say, that's for you, you know? They'll say, no, you can't even walk out of your house on Sunday. The whole village must stay quiet or for an hour or a few hours, maybe a whole day, whatever. And where you just, I have sat there and watched good waves, but there's some taboo saying no. And obviously, you have to respect it at that point. So.
Right. So are there any projects planned for the future or you're working on right now?
I'm doing some big stories for The New Yorker. I just finished a big piece about the New York City subway system, which has a lot of problems. I'm sort of interested in transportation. And I have another book that I've been working on that's actually about the railroad. I spent a few years after college working on the railroad in California. Not passenger rail, that's more common in Europe and pretty uncommon in the United States, but freight rail, cargo railway. It was a really interesting time in my life. I loved that job. I worked with really interesting people, and I've convinced my publisher that there's a book there, so I'm working on it.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Okay. What's the difference at the writing process between this one and the one of surfing?
Well, so far, surfing is something I have done with friends. And this book, Barbarian Days, is as much about friendship as it is about surfing. This book is about people I worked with who weren't, I became friends with some of them, but these weren't, you know, profound friendships through my life. And so I don't have the same resources. I can't go back to these old friends and talk about what happened. I mean, I'm not in touch with these people anymore. So there's that. It feels kind of like I'm having to pull this out of my diaries, out of my journals, out of my memory, my letters, in a different way. And so it's more difficult, and it was kind of lonelier in a way, that work, because the big thing about that work was that you needed to become competent to be safe, and you'd be in a small crew working, and the other people on the crew, if you were new, it was your first year, they just hated you because you really endangered them. I mean, there was always a chance that you would do something stupid and they would get killed. It was dangerous work. And I understood that. And so I was working so hard to become someone you could trust. And there was a kind of loneliness in that because no one was going to say, you know, you're okay now, we trust you. It would be a very slow process and they were not in a hurry to approve you in any way. It was different from surfing where, you know, you surf together, you get a good wave. Oh, I saw your wave. It was great. You know, if I did my job well as a brakeman, I was a brakeman on the railroad, they'd say, all right, kid, you know, there'd be like no particular acknowledgement. You know, I was just doing what I was supposed to be doing. You couldn't do it spectacularly well. You just do it safely. So it has different parameters. And And I hope I can make that world come alive, because as I said, I really loved the work, I loved the job, the whole world we were in. As you know, it's a very working class, very traditional American job and world, and it's kind of closed, a little bit like surfing, it's closed to everybody else. You speak your own language, the railroad has its own language to describe the work. And I have enough notes. I tried to write a novel about working on the railroad. I have that large resource. So I have the language there, but I have to give it life. Okay. I don't know. I hope I can.
It's a challenge.
It's a big challenge. Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah, I have a lot of fun and passion, like the book before.
I hope so, yeah.
Thanks so much. Thanks so much. I'm already looking forward to your reading tonight.
Okay, great. See you there.